You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, we'll ask what the highly influential sci-fi series means to you.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss wrote an opinion piece calling on the UW system to diversify the political stances of invited speakers.
Robert Menser joins us now for the details of this and other top stories from the week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica, thanks.
So I want to start out with an opinion piece from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss saying that he thinks the UW system should diversify its invited speakers, the people that it has to come to address the public and students. What did that piece say? What's he getting at?
Yes, so Voss published this op-ed on the conservative opinion site Right Wisconsin, and what he says is that his office tracked the speakers invited by the state's four-year UW campuses by the amount spent and by, quote, the person's possible ideology. And so having done this analysis, he shares that they found less than a handful of conservatives, and they didn't release any of the data, so I guess we have to trust him on that. It could be true. There certainly is a case that in general, college campuses and young people in general lean to the left, and there have been a lot of sort of high profile cases from around the country, not so much in Wisconsin, where students organize protests of conservative speakers or shout them down in the middle of their speeches or whatever. And so this, in a sense, seems to be Voss's response to that happening kind of in the air and saying that that UW should stand up for the free market of ideas. The problem, or the place where it sort of goes off the rails, is this idea of tracking the person's possible ideology. What he mentions, Michael Sam, the first openly gay NFL player, who was paid to speak at the UW lacrosse. And I mean, I guess you could say that it's a liberal cause in some sense, the right of an athlete to be open about his sexuality. But I mean, it also seems like a very good, interesting speaker for a university that has sponsors athletics and so on. So it's a little weird, and it possibly is. It makes me at least a little skeptical of what this really shows. I would like to see these lists. It's an interesting topic, but I would just like to know more about what he's actually getting at.
Well, and towards the end of the piece, he seemed to be getting at maybe a bigger point that he felt that there was an overemphasis on what he calls political correctness at universities and a stifling of some kinds of speech in favor of others.
Absolutely, yeah. The quote towards the top, perhaps what could be most worrisome about going to college these days, Voss wrote, is the plague of political correctness that creates an environment that ends up stifling free speech and potentially damaging the minds of tomorrow. And of course, listen, it's important to probably note that that this comes at the same time that the UW system leaders have requested a budget increase of $42 million in the next biennial budget. Voss and other Assembly Republicans sort of unveiled their legislative priorities for the next session, and you can kind of see the machinery getting to work on budget work. And so, I mean, what it speaks to most of all, I think, is the gulf between sort of how UW system leaders see themselves and how they're viewed by conservative politicians.
That charge of political correctness is also a major talking point of presidential candidate Donald Trump. Do you read any kind of support for some of that same agenda here from Speaker Voss, or is it just happenstance?
I mean, I think it's a big part of the conservative movement generally, right? I mean, like I said, it's not made up out of whole cloth. There really have been these incidents of conservative speakers at college campuses getting shouted down. To some extent, the political correctness is a useful tool for conservative politicians as well. And, I think we do want to, it makes sense to me, it feels like we do want a marketplace of ideas, and the university should serve that function. I just wonder how, how some of these things are classified and how were they necessarily like even all that partisan, what might have been categorized as liberal speakers.
Well, sticking with the state's Republicans right now, also this week, Speaker Voss and Assembly Republicans released their legislative agenda. What were the main highlights?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, the, probably one of the most interesting things that stands out is a proposal to put a laptop or tablet in the hands of every student in Wisconsin by high school freshmen. And this would represent a move forward and an investment in technology and in the education system. That's interesting. Certainly, the Assembly Republicans, you know, roads are always a big one, right? Paying for the filling the transportation deficit is always big. Assembly Republicans have been more open than sometimes Republicans in the Senate, and much more than Governor Walker, to the concept of, you know, new revenues, taxes to pay for those road fixes. So that's part of it. And one I like, here's one. They're going to look at legislation to allow driverless cars on Wisconsin roads. So maybe that'll happen.
And also, a right to try bill was one that caught my eye.
Yeah, indeed. They unveiled a whole bunch of things. So the right to try is those with terminal illnesses who would get easier access to experimental treatments. And that certainly, I mean, that could be beneficial. And who knows? It's a roadmap. We'll see what all makes its way into actual legislation.
And when do we expect Democrats to get their agenda out there?
The Democrats, well, I mean, I think that they are focusing on trying to gain ground in the election if they can. They'll certainly want to make their views known in the budget process, and often as a minority party, that happens through by unveiling a shadow proposal, a counter proposal. But I bet that's next year.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And on Tuesday, Governor Scott Walker's office announced a new contract negotiated with AT&T to expand the BadgerNet Converge network. And this may mean some savings. Tell us about that, Rob.
Yeah, so here's a piece of good news. This is the statewide internet infrastructure that serves school districts in all 72 counties, and also government buildings and some other, like community centers or other public places. And it's expensive, but it's a big deal. It provides access to a lot of, to the high-speed internet and other technology things for schools. So right now, what we have, the network we have, costs $25.3 million a year for a bandwidth of 90 gigabytes per second. The new contract will cost less, cost $17.3 million a year, and will increase bandwidth by something like 4.5 times. It'll be up to 408 gigabytes of bandwidth. So that's an upgrade. That's a good thing.
And lastly, Rob, yesterday there was some news about Planned Parenthood and legal fees. What's the latest on that story?
Yeah, so we talked about the abortion restrictions that were struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in June. And on Thursday, the Wisconsin Department of Justice agreed to pay $1.6 million in the legal costs incurred by Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union and other plaintiffs who successfully challenged that law. It comes on the heels of similar agreements in North Carolina, Missouri, Alabama. So all the states that had similar laws, the laws were like these admitting privileges laws that applied to abortion providers and no one else. That was what was struck down. And so the taxpayer is stuck with a bill of $1.6 million in Wisconsin for the challenges to those laws.
And do you think that this issue is going to come up in court again, or do you think it's settled for at least a little while?
Well, so this came about after I sort of listed off all those states, and what happened was a bunch of states were passing new abortion restrictions. I think the anti-abortion movement saw it as a way to try to challenge the legal status quo, and so that legal part certainly did hit a legal wall there. What's interesting is politically, I don't know whether there's any impact on the political situation. It's obvious obviously in the political self-interest of Republican politicians to be seen as doing everything they can to fight abortions. I don't get the sense that there are a lot of people in the anti-abortion movement who say, well, it just wasn't worth it for $1.6 million. So, I think it's just it speaks to how divided we are on the question. And I think that there are a lot of people who would say it was worth that money to try to see if they could get these new restrictions in.
Rob, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you.
That was Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he joins us every Friday to talk about the top Wisconsin stories from the week.
Space, a final frontier.
Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the groundbreaking series from Gene Roddenberry. It was one of the first shows to have a multi-ethnic cast and explore current social issues through the lens of a fictional spacefaring adventure show with Captain Kirk at the helm.
It's a show that has spawned plenty of spin-off series, including The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, a couple more, and countless films and reboots.
And it's amassed hundreds of thousands of fans, if not millions, the world over.
And on this 50th anniversary of the show, we want to hear from you. Are you one of those Star Trek fans? What did the show mean to you? What does it mean to you? Who were your favorite characters? Did you learn something? Everything you needed to know, you learned from Star Trek. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org.
And we have a comment here from John Munson, WPR's Northern Regional Manager, who said, I was 13 when the show first went on the air in 1966. I remember sitting on the living room floor in front of the television watching it. I thought it was amazing. I like the positive view of the future.
That was our own John Munson. You can share your favorite thoughts, your thoughts on Star Trek, your favorite characters, why you like the show, if you are really into it, if you have fond memories of watching it in syndication late at night. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Paul Breen, another one of our colleagues, said his favorite captain was Captain Kirk, probably because William Shatner was such an unpretentious ham. The only captain I didn't like was, I heard about this earlier today, Captain Sisko from Deep Space Nine, as Avery Brooks was a pretentious ham. Yeah, I ran into Paul.
He was your favorite character.
My favorite captain. Commander, technically, I guess. But yeah, I ran into Paul, and he scolded me for my choice. But that's okay. We can all have different opinions.
Well, I will say I'm a second-generation Trekkie.
That's when I really got into Star Trek. Yeah.
And she, in fact, was in a Mr. Spock fan club when she was in high school. I never went that far. Yeah, Spock was pretty good, pretty cool, though. But I think it's neat to see the different generations of Star Trek through the years. And it keeps going. People keep loving this show. And I'm curious, are you enthusiastic about the new TV series? Are you seeing the new movies? And what do you think about that reboot? I think it's Chris Pine who plays the new Captain
Kirk. Latest movie out this summer.
Is it working out? Do you think it's made that successful leap to the next iteration of Star Trek? Or do you think it already had its heyday and its heyday is over and it's time to move on? I'm still into it. What do you think? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And if you've never gotten into it, let us know why. Or if you'd want to persuade someone who's never watched it before, tell us about it. 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. Phil starts us off in Ladysmith. Hi, Phil.
Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Good. What are your Star Trek memories, Phil?
Well, my topic would be what scientists don't understand, which is what they developed, which is the cell phone and the Blu-ray. And they're from Star Trek. Okay? That's all I want to say.
Phil, thank you so much for that call. And yeah, you read about scientist designers basing some of their designs on what they saw on Star Trek. So I was just, one of our bosses was mentioning, saying, yeah, some of the earliest cell phones, the flip phones, were designed based on
the
tricorders in Star Trek. So yeah, it had influence. And I remember seeing a documentary where a lot of the original Star Trek cast was touring a NASA facility, and all these astronauts and scientists were just amazed that they were meeting these actual Star Trek characters. And the Star Trek guys are like, but we're meeting you guys who actually go out into space, like real space. So being kind of surprised. So a lot of influence there from the pop culture world into the science world.
Let's take another call here. We've got Pat joining us in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm not a real big Trekkie fan, but I had an album, you know, way back when there were albums. And it was from Spock, and the title, I think, was Spock Sings Songs from Outer Space.
I've heard about that. How is it sung?
I liked it, and I don't have it anymore. That was way back, but I wondered if anyone else remembers that or had that album. And,
yeah.
It was pretty cool. Anyway, that was my
That's
comment.
So funny. Man, I wish we could play some of that right now.
I'm
but
sure
we
it's available on the interwebs. Pat, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And then there are the William Shatner albums, not really Star Trek-based, the dramatic reenactments of Mr. Tambourine Man and others. Back to our callers now as we talk about Star Trek, your memories of the show, your favorites, your least favorites, 800-642-1234. Pete is on the line now in Wisconsin Dells. Pete, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Very interesting. I actually just tuned in and kind of excited that you guys are talking about this. Now, I don't consider myself a Trekkie per se, but I do remember growing up as a child. I was born in the 70s, and I remember watching the Star Trek with Captain Kirk. And, you know, very interesting. My mom would watch a lot, so I would always watch it. And then as I got older, there was, like, the Next Generation. And even though I was never a Trekkie, I just remember watching it a lot. And then it kind of went away for a while, and now with this new movie that came out, I was kind of excited. It kind of brought back a lot of memories for me of just as being a child. And I'm just wondering, you know, how many people would actually be like that? Was it not quite a Trekkie, but would, you know, be happy that it came out again and brought back all those memories?
The nostalgia, Pete.
Yeah, for the nostalgia. It's just great and very interesting, and thanks for letting me make my comments on air. Have a good day.
Thank you so much. And I think I'm kind of in Pete's category. I was never among, you know, your core group of Trekkies or Trekkers, and I don't even want to start that argument.
Which is odd, because you seem like you would be.
I'm not, but I'm a kind of a nerd of all trades, though. Yeah. I don't really focus on one thing. But I'm in Pete's category where I remember watching the old ones. I remember watching Next Generation in college. And definitely I have that nostalgia value of how I watched it, who I watched it with, that kind of thing.
And, of course, we haven't even touched on, you know, the most explosive question in the whole Star Trek verse, which is Kirk or Picard.
Right. Well, maybe our listeners can help us out. 800-642-1234. Back to our callers, Susan on the line in Cedarburg. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Susan?
Well, I just wanted to say that I was probably one of the earliest fangirls. At 10 years old, my cousin and I used to write fan mail to William Shatner telling him how much we loved him above Leonard Nimoy. Huh. We used to go and get the fan magazines that would give all, you know, the latest scoop on what was going on behind the scenes.
Wow.
So it was cool. I loved it. I loved the show. There was a little booklet that they would send out that you could buy all kinds of, you know, wonderful memorabilia at the time. But, of course, 10 years old, I didn't have any money to buy any of it with. But so it's always kind of held a special place in my heart.
And, Susan, I got to ask, did William Shatner ever write you and your cousin back?
No, but I actually, I had an autographed picture.
That's the next best
thing. Do you still like him, Susan?
You know what? I do. I thought he was the greatest captain because, like somebody else mentioned, he was a great ham. You know, he just really played up the part, and I just loved that series. There was just everything about it I loved. My husband loves it as well.
All right. Well, thanks, Susan. So there's one vote for Captain Kirk. And we'll take another call. Marina joins us next in Pleasant Prairie at 800-642-1234. Marina, hi.
Hi. Hello. Good afternoon. My favorite one, was a series, was a show where they had shown scientists had eradicated all diseases, and as a result, the inhabitants of this particular planet became overpopulated, and they had to beg Captain Kirk and McCoy to please allow them because they had their. It's almost like the Native Americans, right? They had diseases that would help. They realized their era. And then just real quickly, may I also suggest you guys do one on the Twilight Zone?
Ooh. That'd be fun. They're not still making movies of that, but that is definitely a lot of nostalgia, and I can't think too much about those if I want to sleep at night. Marina, thank you so much for that call. And yeah, a lot of real science fiction authors try to tackle issues on that show.
That's right. And that's an episode I don't remember. I'm vaguely wondering if it's the one where Spock swings from the trees. But no, I think that's the Spores one. I don't know the first, the original quite so well. But
yeah,
thank you
neither.
For reminding us about that one. And we've got another caller here. Betsy is joining us. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I've always loved Star Trek. I started watching it when I was really little. I graduated and went to college in 1969. And my favorite thing that I like about it is Galaxy Quest, the spoof of
yes.
it done by Tim and, you know, Sigourney Weaver and the great actor from Britain who just died.
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That movie reduces me to total giggles every time I see it.
Yeah, that's an amazing movie. It's a fun one to watch with kids, too. You don't even have
yeah.
to really necessarily watch the original Star Trek to get that movie. So, yeah, thanks for reminding us about all that, Betsy.
Time for one more quick call from Amber in Kaukauna. Amber, hi.
Hi. I am calling to just talk about the fact that I'm in my early 40s, and I grew up a big fan of TOS and then became a big fan of The Next Generation. And I would consider myself a Trekkie or a Trekker, but I do not like the new movies. They remind me a little bit of, like, Fast and Furious, whereas when you think of the original series and The Next Generation, there was a lot of thought-provoking discussions underlying a lot of that, and in these new ones, I don't see that at all.
Amber, thanks so much for that call.
We appreciate all these thoughts and feelings, deeply held convictions about Star Trek as we celebrate the 50th anniversary this week. And don't forget, you can continue the conversation and take your comments and your thoughts to the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, a look at foreign policy, national security policy in the presidential race. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, Ken and his guests look at the home stretch in the 2016 campaign and a tough election for longtime Republican Senator John McCain. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, as the countdown continues to Election Day, it's only 59 days until voters head to the polls to cast their ballots for president.
And as both major party candidates hit the campaign trail and make a case for their candidacy to the public, one platform has begun taking center stage for both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. National security. Both candidates took the stage earlier this week in an NBC forum on national security issues.
And this comes on the eve of the 15th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Jeremy Suri joins us now for a look at those issues and the candidates' approaches. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Jeremy, big picture. In the past, I can think of elections where it was the economy stupid one time after September 11th. National security issues were at the forefront. How do you see foreign policy and national security playing a role in this presidential election?
Well, it's a very strange presidential election, which is the most obvious thing to say, but that's where we have to start, Rob. National security seems to matter this year less for policy reasons than for what it tells us about the temperament and the character of each of the candidates. This seems so far to be a election that's really devoid of any serious policy discussion, and it's almost entirely focused on who's the better character to be president or really who's the least bad of the two. And national security, as we saw in this most recent forum, really is a way of the candidates trying to show that they are ready for the job or attack their opponent for not being ready for the job.
And we couldn't really have much different resumes between the top two candidates. Hillary Clinton, a former Secretary of State, a former U.S. Senator, has dealt with these issues. Donald Trump, a business person, all we can glean from his past is comments sometimes on the Howard Stern show. And I could see that as a blessing and a curse on either side. Let's look at Hillary Clinton first. you could say, oh, she has this experience. This prepares her to deal with these issues. On the other hand, it means she's made a lot of decisions that people on the left wing of her own party disagreed with during the primaries, and people can criticize her on now.
That's correct. Hillary is a hawk on many, many foreign policy issues. She advocated for support of the efforts to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. She supported the war in Iraq. She supported the surge in American forces in Afghanistan when President Obama became president. So as Secretary of State, she has been an interventionist, and she's been an advocate of more American force overseas. And as you said, Rob, that has alienated her from some of the progressive elements of the Democratic Party that want to see a less interventionist American foreign policy.
I want to give a listen to Hillary Clinton now at that forum we mentioned earlier, looking back at the origins of the American invasion of Iraq.
I think that the decision to go to war in Iraq was a mistake. And I have said that my voting to give President Bush that authority was, from my perspective, my mistake. I also believe that it is imperative that we learn from the mistakes, like after action reports are supposed to do. And so we must learn what led us down that path so that it never happens again.
As you mentioned, Jeremy, Hillary Clinton, often seen as an interventionist, a hawkish foreign policy. There, it sounds like she's trying to downplay that a little to say, hey, we need to learn from our mistakes, my mistake in that case?
Right. Well, what she's long sought to do, Rob, is define what she thinks is smart power. That's a phrase she used actually from her first confirmation hearings as Secretary of State. And for her, smart power means the use of American force, sometimes the flagrant use of American force, but doing it in a wise and determined and focused way. And so her comments on Monday were consistent with, or I guess it's Tuesday, were consistent with what she has said before, which is that she favors the use of force, but she also doesn't favor the use of force everywhere. She regrets the way force was used in Iraq, but she has not renounced the use of force in Libya, in Afghanistan, and in many other locations. She advocated the Secretary of State using force in Syria, for example.
She seems to be putting limits now, and again at this forum, on specific types of intervention in Iraq and Syria. Here's a listen.
They are not going to get ground troops. We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again, and we're not putting ground troops into Syria. We're going to defeat ISIS without committing American ground troops.
Now, Jeremy, as I understand it, I mean, we do have some forces in Iraq in advisory capacities, but she's saying no, I guess, larger scale direct combat activity by American ground troops against ISIS.
Right. Well, we're in this place where both candidates are arguing that we're going to defeat ISIS and various other enemies with minimal risk to American lives. Which just is not realistic in any way. Where she has been consistent, certainly, though, is her belief that American force must involve multilateral action. So part of that statement that you played is her argument that there will be forces on the ground, but they shouldn't necessarily be American forces, perhaps the forces of our allies on the ground and American force in the air.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin, looking at national security issues in the presidential race. We heard a couple of the statements from Hillary Clinton there that got some of the most attention in this forum earlier this week. Turning now to Donald Trump, let's give him a listen now. He said the U.S. had made a mistake when leaving Iraq.
I've always said, shouldn't be there, but if we're going to get out, take the oil. If we would have taken the oil, you wouldn't have ISIS.
Now, people have played a clip of Donald Trump early on in the Iraq War saying he guessed he supported it. But that idea of we should have controlled, we should have taken the oil has gotten a lot of attention. He says that would cut off the economic base for ISIS. What do you make of that as a proposal for national security policy, Jeremy?
Well, I've talked to a lot of people who understand oil issues better than I do. As you can imagine, there are a lot of people in Texas who understand oil. And no one has been able to explain to me what his statement meant. There's no sense in it at all. What were we going to do? Pull all the oil out of the ground? Is that what he means? I mean, that's, first of all, not possible. Second, the last people in the world who want to see that happen are American oil producers, because already the price of oil is too low from their point of view. It would bring the price of oil down even further. And third, if the realistic thing that he's arguing for would be for us to occupy the oil wells, that would actually require, to occupy and manage the oil wells, more of an American troop presence. So his argument that we could get out and somehow magically pull the oil with us through the cloud, I guess, I don't know, like he thinks we can do everything through the cloud, I don't know how that would happen, and I don't know how we would do that without getting more fully involved on the ground in Iraq and without hurting our own oil producers. All of my oil friends in Texas think that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Even people who support him think what he said is ridiculous.
Another statement that got a lot of attention, Trump's admiration or kind words about Vladimir Putin in Russia. There's been a lot of criticism of him from the Hillary Clinton campaign. Here he is at that forum this week.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. I mean, you can say, oh, isn't that a terrible thing he called him? I mean, the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. We have a divided country.
So there's been criticism of Donald Trump for his kind statements about Putin. But there have been accusations that the Democrats now are basically taking old-fashioned red baiting, bringing it into a new millennium here and accusing Republicans of being too friendly to Russia. What do you make of that back and forth?
I think, Rob, there are two separate issues here that are really quite important. One is, do we believe our foreign policy should be about coddling up to authoritarian leaders? Democrats and Republicans over the last 50 years have done too much of that. I'm one of many historians who has written about this. We coddled up to Pinochet. We coddled up to Franco. We coddled up actually for a while to Mussolini. And look what it got us. In every one of these cases, it's blown up in our faces. It's our problem in Saudi Arabia now. So the first issue is this. Just because someone's an effective leader at home, whatever effective means, that they're able to maintain authority, does that mean they should be our friend? Are they actually serving our interests? That's the first thing, putting Russia per se aside. Second issue is when you have a figure who has been on the record that he's pursuing his national interests, and he sees his national interests as being the weakening and the hurting of American relations in his region, and whether he's justified or not is another story, seeing that person as an ally simply because they say nice things about you seems a very naive way to approach foreign policy. And the evidence is pretty strong that Vladimir Putin has been trying to tamper with the American election. There were Russian hackers who were employed by the Russian state who, it appears, broke into Democratic servers. And so I think this is very dangerous. I don't think it's red baiting. It would be red baiting if it were about being anti-Russian. This is more about Putin and about authoritarianism.
We're talking with Jeremy Suri right now about how national security has taken center stage this week during the 2016 presidential election. Jeremy's a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you see national security as a top issue? Do you agree with Hillary Clinton that Donald Trump isn't qualified to speak on the issue? Or do you agree with Donald Trump that Hillary Clinton will be soft when it comes to national security? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about how national security is playing a significant role in the 2016 presidential race. And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think national security should play a large role in the race for the White House? And do you agree with either of the candidates' national security platforms? You worried about one or both of them? Call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jeremy Suri stays with us. He's Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Before we go to our callers, Jeremy, we heard some of what the candidates were saying about national security, and you mentioned it's more of a code for how they would lead in a way. But what would you like to hear from the candidates? What policy platforms do we need to know more about? What issues should they be talking about?
Well, when they talk about combating ISIS, we need to hear less about how they're going to defeat ISIS because they're so great, and more about how they're going to do it. And talking about secret plans, but then saying nothing about them doesn't get us anywhere. So we need specifics on that. We also need a serious discussion of the future of many of our alliances, in particular NATO. With the Brexit from the European Union, with the challenges that Russia is posing to NATO, do we believe that the security structure, Rob, that we built after World War II that served us very well, do we believe that security structure is the structure we want for the next 8 to 10 years, or do we need a new one? And then the third issue that we've heard almost nothing about is climate change. That is a major international issue. It's one of the top issues that President Obama and Premier Xi Jinping were discussing in China, as well as other international leaders. I have no idea where our candidates stand on these issues. In fact, it's quite striking they're not even asked about these issues. So those would be my top three.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Todd on the line in Sparta. Todd, hi.
Hello. Yes, thanks for taking my call today. Earlier you were discussing how Hillary was criticizing Donald Trump, and I'd just like to point out that I don't think she has any room to criticize anybody else on national security with her track record of what happened in Benghazi. And the deal with the Democratic email being hacked, are we talking about Hillary's unauthorized email and a security violation there, or the Democratic authorized emails?
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. And these are the main Republican lines of attack on Hillary Clinton and national security, pointing at the deaths, the diplomatic staff in Benghazi and Libya, and saying that she didn't handle important national security information in a safe manner, Jeremy.
Okay, well, I appreciate Todd's comments. The Benghazi issue is a serious one, right? One of the most important things the Secretary of State is responsible for, and she was Secretary of State, is making sure that American diplomats are doing the best possible job to represent the United States and serve American interests. What Secretary Clinton did, and I saw a little bit of this up close, was she encouraged all American diplomats, in the same way that Petraeus encouraged all American soldiers, to get out of their bases, to get out of the embassies, go out and meet more people, to connect, and to do the work of building the relationships the United States needed. And Chris Stevens, who was a magnificent person and a magnificent diplomat, died as a consequence of that. She de-emphasized protecting our diplomats and emphasized having our diplomats do their jobs. General Petraeus did exactly the same thing. She did the right thing. And in fact, and I hope Todd remembers this, there were extensive hearings and extensive investigations. The Republicans spent more than a year and a half investigating this, and they found nothing, absolutely nothing on this. She was doing her job. She was doing the right thing as Secretary of State. The other comments about this are ridiculous. Now, on the email. She certainly did the wrong thing with her emails. She should not have been using her private emails, or private server, for a classified email. That's absolutely right. But I thought we were talking about foreign policy issues here. I would agree she made mistakes there, but if that's really what we're talking about, my gosh, we have a candidate on the other side who's gone bankrupt 4 times, who's has a list of about 1,000 creditors he's never paid, who repeatedly lies. I don't really think that's what the campaign should be about. But if we want to make it about truthfulness, there's no one less truthful than the person on the other side from her. So I hope we can talk about the issues, not about this nonsense any further. Who's going to be the best person to help produce the best policies for our country and for the world, not who's going to be claiming the other person's more of a liar than the other one.
Todd, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jeremy Suri, political scientist from the University of Texas, Austin, also a historian, looking at national security issues, foreign policy issues in the presidential race. We go now to Ricardo in Racine. Ricardo, hi.
Hi, thanks. You know, I really like what Hillary's been saying over what Trump has been saying about national security. She has plans. She has ideas. She's worked around the world as Secretary of State, and Trump seems to just throw out kind of blundering things. I've got a plan. We're going to be wonderful. We're going to be great. She has details, and she's willing to throw them out there. So I'm going with her 100% on national security.
Ricardo, thanks for the call. Do you see fleshed-out plans from the Clinton campaign, Jeremy, on some of the key issues you're looking for?
On some, not on all. I'd like to see more. I think she has also gotten too much into the mud and the dirt, and maybe that's unavoidable. Maybe that is her fault. I don't know. But I think she's laid out some very clear and thoughtful positions on American policy toward China. She's laid out some thoughtful and clear positions on immigration. She's laid out some thoughtful and clear positions on the U.S. relationship with Europe, on nuclear issues, on nuclear proliferation, on relations with Iran. So those are, I think, her strong points, and there's no equivalent on Trump's side. But there are lots of other areas where she has not said very much. Climate change, as I mentioned before. So as a policy guy, I'd like to see more discussion of policy. I have this old-fashioned view, Rob, that we should choose leaders based on their policy positions and their policy leadership, not on whether they smile or whether they can claim the other person was more of a liar. And I would also point out on this that on these issues that we just brought up, many on the Republican side who worked for George W. Bush have endorsed Hillary's positions and pledged not to work for Trump because of, just as Ricardo said, he doesn't really even have positions on these issues.
Ricardo, thanks for that call. I want to look at a couple of issues in the news, Jeremy, that the next president will have to deal with. Big nuclear test from North Korea, just hearing news about that today. I mean, a lot of presidents have tried and failed to come to some sort of resolution in North Korea. What is facing the next president-elect?
Well, this is a very difficult issue because North Korea has developed a nuclear capability, and they're a somewhat reckless regime, and they seem to try to hold their neighbors hostage with these weapons. They're a failed state in many ways, but they're a state with nuclear weapons. I think there are two things that need to happen, and these are not areas where President Obama has succeeded. So these are present failures that need to be addressed better by the next president. First, we need to build a more effective relationship with both the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Koreans as a third entity, and probably South Koreans are the most important entity, to put pressure on the North Koreans and have a united front when confronting them. The Chinese condemned the North Korean nuclear test today, but they continue to send electricity and aid to North Korea. If we really want to force the North Koreans to rethink their policies, China has to join our sanctions, and we need to bring them in on that. That's a diplomatic endeavor. And then second, we need to have a more effective mechanism of penetrating the North Korean regime and trying, quite frankly, to encourage change from within. That's very difficult. We've failed. We valorize our intelligence agencies and our military, but so far we haven't figured out how to crack this regime, and I think that's important. I think there's a humanitarian reason not to try to determine who the next leader of North Korea is, but to try to force this regime to open up.
Jeremy, briefly, as we wrap up the September 11th, 15th anniversary this Sunday, a brief thought on job one for the next president in counterterrorism.
I think job one is not to let the terrorists set our agenda. I've written a bit about this, Rob. I think if we look back on these 15 years as historians, what we'll say is that in some ways the terrorists have won because they have pulled us in their direction. We have defined our policy by them. Just think about it. We're debating whether we're defeating ISIS. No, it should be about what our agenda is in the region. We need to articulate some real goals, and then we need to pursue those goals and defeat the terrorists in the pursuit of goals we care about, not just reacting to them.
Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Jeremy Suri is the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and a professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He joins us today to talk about national security issues in the 2016 presidential race. You can share your thoughts, maybe the issue that matters most to you in foreign policy. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we hear the story of a sociologist who set off on a road trip to meet the people opposite her on the political divide and how they found common ground.
We'll talk to one of our WPR reporters who's embedding with a new class of police recruits. We'll hear what she's hoping to learn along the way.
And from the quest to live to 100 to the plague, we check in with Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine to get the latest in science news. She's always got a lot of amazing and interesting stories to cover with us.
All that plus Wisconsin life and a look at the top news stories of the day. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Monday after 7 on the State Capitol Report, Republican Assembly leaders laid out their agenda for the new session in 2017. Joy talks to lawmakers from both parties about the issues raised, from education to road funding to taxes and spending. That's coming up Monday morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then after ITT Tech announced its shutdown this week, we hear how Wisconsin students of the for-profit college are reacting. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.